Yeah, it sort of seems as though it's discussed in the media as well, as though it's something that we can negotiate, when in fact, the science is pretty clear about what we need to do to avoid triggering that catastrophic change.
That's right. I think what does need to be negotiated in Paris is, where does the burden fall? Whose responsibility is it to do what? So part of the big conversation there and part of the controversy there is, whose role is it to cut emissions the fastest, cut pollution the fastest? Whose responsibility is it to support those countries who are low income or have large populations of people under the poverty line to move off of dirty energy pathways? Whose responsibility is it to pay for losses and damages that have already happened, that are locked in because of the pollution that's been historically put in the atmosphere? For example, we see almost every year now, sadly, during the climate talks, a typhoon hits the Philippines. I mean, we saw the worst one 3 years ago when the climate talks were in Doha. We saw it again last year. It's devastating. That kind of loss and damage is locked in because those emissions are already in the atmosphere. The question is, who's responsible for paying for that? Is it the Philippine government? Is it the population of the Philippines, who's largely low income, or is it the countries that have been responsible for 150 years of cheap fossil fuel pollution? We've gotten rich here in the United States on cheap coal in the past, and countries like India say, hey, we've still got a huge population that doesn't have access to electricity and basic needs. So it's fair for us to want to develop in the cheapest way as well, and of course that means coal. So what we really need to say here in the United States to our government is, okay, India obviously can't produce the kind of global emissions that we have using the cheapest and dirtiest fossil fuel sources. So what kind of support do we need to provide, both financially and through technology, to make sure that India has the cleanest kinds of fuels to develop their and meet their electricity needs possible? So how can we be providing money, technology, resources, capacity to make sure that folks in India have access to renewable energy? And then how can we do that here at home also? Because we deserve clean power here in our communities in the U.S. as well.
We've been speaking with Janet Redmond, Director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. They're online at ips-dc.org. Thank you very much, Janet Redmond, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6:02, and next is a two-hour special for Transgender Day of Remembrance, starting right now with Bread and Roses. Stay tuned.
KBOO is proud to host the entire series of the podcast The Spirit of the Forest, an audio drama, dark comedy, and semi-musical outsider art program. It's created by independent producer Dan Krall from Corvallis, and the program reflects upon the sadness, the absurdity, and normalcy of modern life. Listen to The Spirit of the Forest on demand at kboo.fm/thespiritoftheforest.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of grain, are touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
I'm your host, Nia Nguyen, and our engineer tonight is Delphine Crescenzo. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists. We give voice to those working for social justice and equity, globally and locally, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All this, and we have fun. We always welcome new collective members, no experience necessary. To find out more about how you can host, produce, or engineer with us, you can contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator at volunteer@kboo.org. That's volunteer@kboo.org. Don't forget to like KBOO Bread and Roses on Facebook to get updates and see behind-the-scenes photos. We are also on Twitter at Bread Roses Radio and on the web at www.kboo.fm/breadandroses. There, you can listen to past shows and leave us comments and show ideas. You can also email us suggestions at breadandrosescollective@gmail.com. Tonight on Bread and Roses, we have a conversation on the state of emergency in the transgender community with our high murder rates. There has been 24 reported transgender murders this year. Tonight, I will have my awesome guest, Alyssa Pagan, speak about the epidemic of the unresolved murder cases within the transgender community. Today is Transgender Day of Remembrance. This was a day that was set aside to memorialize those who were killed due to anti-transgender hatred or prejudice. The event is held in November to honor Rita Hester, whose murder on November 28, 1998, kicked off the Remembering Our Dead web project and a San Francisco candlelight vigil in 1999. Rita Hester's murder, like most anti-transgender murder cases, has yet to be solved. The Transgender Day of Remembrance serves several purposes. It raises public awareness of hate crimes against transgender people, an action that current media doesn't perform. Day of Remembrance publicly mourns and honors the lives of our sibling who might otherwise be forgotten. Through the vigil, we express love and respect for our people in the face of national indifference and hatred. Day of Remembrance reminds non-transgender people that we are their children, parents, friends, and lovers. Day of Remembrance gives our allies a chance to step forward with us and stand in vigil, memorializing those of us who died by anti-transgender violence. During the second part of the show, I will be reading the names of the 24 women that were murdered and taken from us this year. For those that are listening, and if you are interested, we have a vigil going on at PCC Cascade Campus at the Moriarty Building right after the show ends at 7 o'clock. If you are moved by tonight's episode and want to come and show solidarity, come join us. So I have my interview with Alyssa Pagan, a badass Black Puerto Rican trans woman. She is a junior at Portland State University, studying women, gender, and sexuality, an activist and an organizer on loan to Portland from New Jersey. This is the interview. So I have Alyssa Pagan with me, and we're going to be talking a little bit about Trans Day of Remembrance. And Alyssa? Hi, how are you?
Hi, Nia. I'm all right. Thank you.
You're welcome. What is Trans Day of Remembrance, if you'd like to let us know? For those who don't know what Trans Day of Remembrance means.
Trans Day of Remembrance is an event that happens across the globe every year where we read the names of trans people that have been killed. And it is a very long list. And it is a time and a space where we remember those who have been taken from us. And ideally, it is a space for healing and a space where people can come away feeling a little less alone in their pain.
Thank you. So one of the things, the specific hashtag that I thought was important is the hashtag Say Her Name. So what does Say Her Name mean? And how does it pertain to the violence against trans women of color?
Say Her Name as a hashtag was one that often accompanied people who used Black Lives Matter hashtags when the person that was taken is a trans woman. And what's brilliant about it, I think, is that it raises awareness, particularly for Black people that are engaged in Black Lives Matter activism and in racial justice activism. It is also a challenge to everyone to say her name, to say the names of the Black trans women that have been taken. And for me, it's been so incredibly touching and helps me to feel optimistic about the kind of involvement that I can have in the fight for justice broadly and from an intersectional lens. Over the summer, I helped to organize an event called Say Her Name, where hundreds of people came to Pioneer Square and uplifted the names of the then 18 trans women that had been killed in this country at that time. This was over the summer. And the number has risen since then. It's 22 now. And we will be saying the names and sharing some of the stories about the trans women that have been taken from us in this country in this last year.
Would you feel comfortable talking about the type of violence that trans women of color, specifically Black trans women of color, go through? Would you feel comfortable talking about that? Or?
Yeah, well, I can't speak for anyone but me.
Right.
I am a Black trans woman, a Black Puerto Rican, just a Latina, Boricua. And I can say that until very recently, I internalized every bit of hate, and there were quite a few bits of hate thrown my way, and believed to a degree what people were saying about me. And if not actually believing what they're saying, believing the implication of what they mean, which is that I have no value, that I don't even deserve to breathe, that I don't deserve to exist in the world, and that it is incumbent upon them to punish me in the moment for living my truth. And what exacerbated that were often the racial implications with my trans identity, where certainly I think that one of the reasons that people felt throughout the years that it was okay to violate me in public was because I am Black and trans, and those two things on their own are already cause for really embarrassing amounts of violence in this country and in the world. But when they're paired together, I think there's a common understanding that's not spoken. Sometimes it is. But usually is not spoken but understood, is that we actually are the lowest of the low. And that any kind of violence that comes our way, including murder, is perfectly acceptable and often preferable. And that's something that I have to walk with all the time and figure out a way to not let it tear me down to the point of not wanting to live anymore, frankly. So I work hard every day to assert my dignity until the world actually believes me.
Thank you. You're such a strong individual.
Thank you.
So how are trans women of color the target for the violence?
Well, despite a lot of rhetoric that is spoken by people in public when they know that people are watching, is we, the collective we, do not accept any forms of bigotry, right? Cis sexism, meaning sexism against trans people. Cis means same, trans means to cross, to change. They will assert that they have no tolerance for cis sexism, have no tolerance for racism, particularly anti-Black racism, as it has become a part of the national dialogue, thanks in large part to the Black Lives Matter movement. However, materially, the actual conditions under which we all live negate those assertions. So they feel very shallow. State violence against Black people, trans people, and definitely Black trans people is so prevalent that when it is actually enacted interpersonally, people really don't bat an eyelash. If people on their way home today hear someone died, someone was murdered on the street without any qualifiers, it will, of course, pique people's interest. What? What happened? This is horrible. And then you get the details. Yeah, it was a Black transgender woman. And by the way, that description is being generous. I don't delude myself in thinking that that is how people always refer to me when I'm not in earshot. Most news articles misgender trans people when they are murdered. So if being disrespected in life wasn't bad enough, they're going to humiliate you in death. But anyway, if that person on the street talking to some stranger says somebody was killed and then says it was a Black transgender woman, well, the alarm will somehow be mitigated because our deaths are not as weighted as other deaths. That also is something that is very hard for me to sit with and think about. But I challenge myself to use that to push myself to fight for justice broadly, not just for the identities that I have, but the fight for justice more broadly. Everything that capitalism has to offer us is probably something that people have seen or heard me protesting.
So what messages do you have for trans people in coping with survival?
I found that political engagement was actually more helpful for me than my many, many years of many, many therapists and counselors and support groups. I'm sure they serve their purpose in the big scheme of things, but looking back, what felt more profound and helpful for me was getting engaged politically. And at first, that political engagement was strictly for and with trans women of color at a place called the Audre Lorde Project in Brooklyn, New York. And that was good. And it opened me up to more activism. This was in 2011. And it was the rise of Occupy Wall Street, if people remember that, in October. And I used to go by there, a place called Zuccotti Park, which is where it originally started, in order to get to work. I used to get off at the World Trade Center stop on the PATH train. I'm from Jersey City, New Jersey. Get off on the PATH train, which is like an underground subway that goes underneath the Hudson River, to the World Trade Center stop. And I would walk across town to catch the subway to go up to my job in Gramercy, a neighborhood in Manhattan. And I encountered these protesters. And when you're in New York, you know, you see people protesting all the time. You see people congregate on the street. You think, so what? I got things to do. Get out of my way. I got my coffee. I got my butter roll. Come on. I got to go. And that's where I was at. And they stayed. It wasn't a one-day thing. It was many days. And on a Friday night, they were out there playing the drums on the west side of the park. And it was good drumming, like I could, irresistible drumming that made the Africa in me move. I couldn't help it. So I went over, started chatting people up. What is this? Why are you people not going home? And I think that night might have been the first night I heard the term income inequality. I was already well into my 20s, and I had never heard it before, even though I had grown up in abject poverty. I should have been well acquainted with the term, because I was very well acquainted with the conditions attached to it. But that really started something in me. I went back the next day, and I went to the General Assembly, where we had the People's Mic, which is something that people use because the NYPD came down hard and said, no amplification in the park. So people got creative. Okay, we'll do the People's Mic. Whoever's talking speaks as loud as they can. Whoever can hear what they said repeats what they said in small spurts. The people that can hear them then do that, and you do that as many times as it takes to make sure that everybody can hear you in the back. And I thought, whoa, these people are good. There were all sorts of working groups. There was a free People's Library, and it was really great. And I was changed forever, I think, because I began to see my oppression. And I might not have even been familiar with the term oppression at the time. Oh, dear. I began to see my oppression as not some accident of life, not some interpersonal encounters with bigoted people. No. The oppression that felt most oppressive and real to me was the oppression that I had dealt to me by the state, by the grand old US of A, and the capitalist system under which it is run that requires that there are a large amount of people who have to live in poverty in the conditions that I was brought up in. And that really helped me to begin the process of not taking the stuff that I went through into personally, so personally, because I began to be able to see through people and understand that they are doing the best that they can under the system they live. And for many people, that means acting out and creating boogie men and women and non-binary boogies. it makes them feel better. It makes them feel at ease for them to know that they can see someone as less than them. They can assert their dominance over them. They can pass all sorts of judgment on them. And everything that the world is telling them, in terms of the way that people dealt with me, everything that the world told them was, yeah, you're absolutely right about this freak. Which is, I know how people felt about me and feel about me. And it helped me to not feel so disempowered and low and worthless. And it made me want to fight for justice. Because if we had a just world, well, then maybe people wouldn't feel so desperate, so angry, so needing boogie people to blame their problems on. Not to mention the fact that I would have equitable access to housing and food and education, the basic necessities of life that none of us are promised, which feels like a deep, deep violation of human dignity. And I am dedicated to fighting it. That gives me meaning. And it helps me to not slip back into survival mode. And I know that took a very long time to answer. And I'm sorry if I put anyone listening to sleep.
No, not at all. No, that was brilliant. Thank you. So I'm quite speechless. That was amazing. So what advice would you give to trans people to mobilize against their oppression?
I would say trans unity is a group that I know in Portland. They helped to host the Say Her Name vigil So that was really great to have that support from them. And we had an amazing event. We all pulled it off late notice, and it was beautiful. So I think that they are a good group of people to work with. If people want to do trans-specific mobilization, fighting for justice more broadly.
Right.
I organize with Don't Shoot Portland, which is founded in racial justice, fighting for racial justice, but we do understand the intersections.
Yes.
And work with other groups, particularly 15 Now, who I also organize with. I'm actually trying to get people to sign the petition to get a $15 minimum wage on the ballot. So if anyone would like to collect signatures, you can pick them up at Jobs with Justice, where I do my internship and some organizing with as well. That's on 1500 Northeast Irving on the fifth floor. People can come in and sign the petition if you just want to sign. But if you are feeling adventurous, you can take a petition sheet or many petition sheets. Each of them has space for 10 signatures and collect signatures, which would be wonderful. So those are organizations off the top of my head that I have been working closely with and that is doing really important work in this town. I feel really fulfilled doing this really important work with these really important organizations, Don't Shoot Portland, 15 Now, and Jobs with Justice.
Can you talk a little bit about police brutality and violence against trans women? Because it is not often talked about, and it's just as prevalent as just, I guess, your regular violence against trans women.
Yeah. What a tragic qualifier, regular violence.
I know.
I can't speak much about PPD. I haven't had any run-ins with them, with the few trans women that I'm friends with here in Portland, but NYPD are really, really brutal, rude, and unapologetic. So me and my homegirls, because before I moved here, when I still lived in Jersey City, and with my stomping grounds were in the city, like any good girl from one of the boroughs or from Jersey, you can make the trek and you hang out in the city. So we would make the trek from Union Square, across 14th Street, over to 7th Avenue, down to Christopher, and then over to the pier. It's a thing. And I'm sure I made somebody smile listening that is from New York, because that is what you do. So even though there were a lot of good times, laughing and talking about life, getting our life, frankly, there were many, many times that the contempt of NYPD was very apparent. The dirty looks, the little grunts under their breath, the laughter, by police, right? And that being normalized, which makes it that much more tragic thinking back on it. I was fortunate never to experience the physical violence of police on the street. But many, many, many of my good girlfriends are not so lucky. And there were all sorts of instances where girls would get picked up by police and charged with solicitation or soliciting prostitution, and would have to go to jail. Would get booked and have to spend the night in jail and get arraigned whenever they arraign you. And there was not a lot of justice for that. Barely any justice for that. The Audre Lorde Project, again, where I got my my activist bones. The trans justice program there that I think still exists and is still doing really good work, by the way. Would go and mobilize for girls that had gotten locked and didn't have anybody there to advocate for them. So the kinds of things that the police would do and say were so dehumanizing. I'm sure people listening can imagine the kinds of indignities that some of the girls that would get locked up would have to endure. You can imagine, and you would be right. So there's no recourse, right? Like whether it's the COs or other people that are locked up. People can disrespect you, and you have to take it. You have to endure it. You have to take the embarrassment. You have to accept that you are disgusting, not worthy of anything resembling respect or consideration. Yeah.
Thank you. So we're going to take a little break right now, and I'm going to be playing a song called Freedom by various artists from the Panther soundtrack. This is a song that Alyssa chose, and I am so happy to play it for you. Enjoy.
No unity, no power.
White power for white people. Black power for black people. 1967. The Black Panther Party. The movement.
Freedom.
Let's talk about freedom. Freedom.
We will not bow down to racism.
We will not bow down to injustice. We will not bow down to
exploitation. I'm gonna stay.
Down. that you hold me inside. Sister, rising up and sing that our time is here. We're taking back what's been lost for years.
Let the heaven of a system embrace you,
yeah,
and praise the mother God.
All these lies and all this propaganda that you want us to sing.
So welcome back to the second part of the show. That song you heard was Freedom by various artists from the Panther soundtrack. Alyssa picked that out for us, so thank you, Alyssa. You've heard from one transgender woman, and I might add a badass transgender woman. So now I'd like to turn the show to a more personal, side. I am also a transgender woman of color, and I am very unapologetic about it. I wasn't always unapologetic about it. I used to be very ashamed of it, and those were the messages that I heard from I continue to hear it, but you know, that was the message. Those were the messages that I heard in my life. I think even the symbolic act of how many transgender women are murdered, I think that is those are more messages on how we are silenced and made invisible, even in our own mind, much less going out to see the world and deal with the world and their hatred and fear with us as the boogie non-conforming gender individual, as Alyssa would say. I've kept myself locked up many, many, many years. And, it's just a tactic that I think, a lot of trans folk people have to, endure for the most part of their life. And I mean, that's, I would imagine why that's why, so many of them decide that the only choice is to kill themselves. And I think that's very heartbreaking that we live in a society that can push an individual to that level where they think that the only choice they have is to end their life because their state and their people do not want them to exist, or they want them to exist in a particular way, depending on how their anatomy works. And I think that's so baffling and enraging to even think about. But that is the reality for many trans individuals and trans communities. I mean, once you overcome that period, I mean, I I overcame that because of my grandmother's death. And she passed, and I kept on getting nightmares for a long time about how my life would turn out had I not transitioned. And I didn't want that to be a prophecy, that I would grow old to be an old man. And I mean, I don't have any problems with, you know, anyone being an old man, but that's just not my identity. That's living a lie for me. So if you want to just jump into my shoes, imagine if you had to live your life as someone else and you had to pretend and you had to look as if you're happy being that person that they have assigned you to. So I think that narrative that a lot of trans women hear about how they will be treated or how permissible it is that violence will be inflicted on their bodies with brute force from the state and from individuals within the state and groups of people in the state, that this violence that will be pushed on trans women of color, it keeps us silenced and it locks us up in a prison within our flesh, and we have to be stronger than this. And it's a catch-22, because how can you be stronger being trapped in your own flesh, being trapped in the shell that you were given, and you can't break free from it. But if you break free, don't let that stop you from going out there. Do not let them silence you. Let them know that you have a right to exist. Your space is sacred to you, and you cannot let them take that away from you. When Alyssa said that she has to assert her dignity onto people, every day that is something that I have to also endure, and I feel that many trans women have to deal with that. In fact, I think many women have to deal with that. They have to exert their dignity because we live in such a sexist and misogynistic, cisism, whatever, all of that stuff type of world where dignity is taken from us, and we have to walk with a type of pride to understand that it's a battle every day. In fact, for me, I have to put on a suit of armor every time I step out my door, because I just don't know how someone's going to react if I smile at them, or if I say hello, or if I don't do anything but look at them. And I've often wondered, like, what is it about my presence and my being that is so repulsive, or that it can just spark so much violence and hatred from another being? And I just don't understand why. I don't have the answer. I don't live in those bodies. I don't understand those thoughts. And it has to get better. So I have written a poem, and I thought I'd share it with you tonight. This is called Boiling. I am boiling in this unnatural heat as my blood runs course through my tight veins. I felt powerless to act, and I am enraged. I am enraged because our bodies are stolen from us, rotting in the street, covered by impunity, found in dumpsters with one too many gunshots and stab wounds, beaten to an unrecognizable pulp because of fear and hate. It isn't just violence on our own bodies. It's the colonizing of our minds. It is the destruction and theft of the lands. It is the policing by violence and terrorism. There are many that don't see it and don't want to believe it. What are you talking about? All lives matter. Why would you side with them? You're Asian. They're black. Maybe because I don't see it like that. Because I'm a person and so are they. Never mind that my family and I are refugees of war and Orientalism. But we came because we were sold freedom, equality, and justice for all. I am enraged because I don't know my own history. Because the stories was kept from me. As I lavished in lies and adorned false white idols about who's the winner and who's powerful, so they could contain my rage by ignorance. I am enraged because it took me 3 decades to see it myself. What took me so long? What can take others so long too? Just because you're not a direct target for them doesn't mean that you're not a target. I am enraged because white power tries to define my reality. You're just overthinking, says my white lover. This has nothing to do with you, says my friend living with internalized racism. It's not always about race, says my roommate. Calm down, says the tone police. I get it. You don't want to hear it. You don't want to hear my anger because it makes you think of your own guilt. So you choose not to hear me. So you choose not to acknowledge me. But that only burns my soul deeper. I am enraged. The only way we can break down the pillars, you must be enraged with me. You must acknowledge my anger and acknowledge your own anger. I am enraged because it just feels right to me that I try to conjure up the nameless, the forgotten, and the invisible. It is not a luxury, but a necessity for me. I hope you like that. I'm going to read off the names of the women that were murdered this year. These are the names of the trans women that were murdered this year. Lamia Beard of Norfolk, Virginia, was 30 years old, and she loved to sing. Her favorite singer was Beyoncé. She spoke fluent French, and she loved to read. She was in the chorus in high school, and people would pay her to sing at funerals and weddings. Lamia was found mortally wounded from a gunshot wound on January 17th, and her sister has no idea why anyone would want to hurt her. Keisha Blige of Montgomery, Illinois, was 33 years old and had a motto, "Live your life and no matter what anybody says." Although she often worked 2 or 3 jobs, she was known for her generosity and willingness to be there for people who she cared about, often taking in friends, family members, and acquaintances that didn't have anywhere to stay. On March 7th, Blige was shot in the shoulder while driving and crashed her navy blue car after attempting to drive herself to the hospital. Police still have yet to make an arrest, but say they do know the shooting was, quote, not random, unquote. Candace Capri, 35, of Phoenix, Arizona, enjoyed spending time with others and going out. Her friends and family variously described her as loving, kind-hearted, and a goddess. She was slain on August 12th, possibly during an attempt to intervene in a domestic dispute. London Chanel of Victoria, Texas, was 21 years old and hardly ever frowned, friends remembered. She always had a smile on her face and her laughter was infectious. She recently reconnected with her mother, who initially struggled to support her transition and was planning to move back home before she was stabbed to death on May 18th. India Clark, 25, of Tampa, Florida, was all into things beauty and makeup and was studying to become a cosmetologist. Her body was discovered on the morning of July 21st. She had been shot in the head. Her last words to her mom and dad were, "Mom, I love you. Dad, I love you." A county spokesman insisted on referring to her as a man in a dress, refused to categorize her as transgender. Taha De Jesus was 36 years old, an active member of Bayview, California Church, a food pantry volunteer, and a trans activist. She got her first job when she was 15 years old, so she could earn enough money to buy a stereo to play music, the music that she loved.
As we come marching at the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. Marching, so many women dead. We cry through our city, their ancient call for bread. Our stomachs are empty, but our hearts are hungry too. Oh, march to four men, for their women's children, and we're mothers again. No more shall we labor from birth till life closes. Oh,
you're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 7 o'clock, and next is the second hour of a KBOO special for Transgender Day of Remembrance. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.